I don't want to hurt her, but we're not close. Our relationship has become empty. I don't enjoy being with her anymore. I don't know what happened. I wish it were different, but I don't have any feelings for her." Brent was thinking and feeling what hundreds of thousands of husbands have thought and felt through the years. It's the "I don't love her anymore" mindset that gives men the emotional freedom to seek love from someone else. The same is true for wives who use the same excuse. I sympathize with Brent, for I have been there. Thousands of husbands and wives have been there, emotionally empty, wanting to do the right thing, not wanting to hurt anyone, but being pushed by their emotional need to seek love outside the marriage. Fortunately, I had discovered in the earlier years of my own marriage the differences between the in-love experience and the emotional need to feel love. Most in our society have not yet learned that difference. The in-love experience that we discussed in Chapter 3 is on the level of instinct. It is not premeditated. It simply happens in the normal context of male-female relationships. It can be fostered or quenched, but it does not arise by conscious choice. It is short-lived, usually 2 years or less, and seems to serve for humankind the same function as the mating call of the Canadian goose. The in-love experience temporarily meets one's emotional need for love. It gives us the feeling that someone cares, that someone admires us and appreciates us. Our emotions soar with the thought that another person sees us as number one, that he or she is willing to devote time and energies exclusively to our relationship. For a brief period, however long it lasts, our emotional need for love is met. Our tank is full. We can conquer the world. Nothing is impossible. For many individuals, it is the first time they have ever lived with a full emotional tank, and the feeling is euphoric. In time, however, we come down from that natural high back to the real world. If our spouse has learned to speak our primary love language, our need for love will continue to be satisfied. If, on the other hand, he or she does not speak our love language, our tank will slowly drain, and we will no longer feel loved. Meeting that need in one spouse is definitely a choice. If I learn the emotional love language of my spouse and speak it frequently, she will continue to feel loved. When she comes down from the obsession of the in-love experience, she will hardly even miss it because her emotional love tank will continue to be filled. However, if I have not learned her primary love language or have chosen not to speak it, when she descends from the emotional high, she will have the natural yearnings of unmet emotional needs. After some years of living with an empty love tank, she will likely fall in love with someone else, and the cycle will begin again. Meeting my wife's need for love is a choice I make each day. If I know her primary love language and choose to speak it, her deepest emotional needs will be met, and she will feel secure in my love. If she does the same for me, my emotional needs are met, and both of us live with a full love tank. In a state of emotional contentment, both of us will give our creative energies to many wholesome projects outside the marriage while we continue to keep our marriage exciting and growing. With all of that in my mind, I looked back at the deadpan face of Brent and wondered if I could help him. I knew in my heart that he was probably already involved with another in-love experience. I wondered if it was in the beginning stages or at its height. Few men suffering from an empty emotional love tank leave their marriage until they have prospects of meeting that need somewhere else. Brent was honest and revealed that he had been in love with someone else for several months. He had hoped that the feelings would go away and that he could work things out with his wife, but things at home had gotten worse, and his love for the other woman had increased. He could not imagine living without his new lover. I sympathize with Brent in his dilemma. He sincerely did not want to hurt his wife or his children, but at the same time, he felt he deserved a life of happiness. I told him the dismal statistics on second marriages. He was surprised to hear that, but was certain that he would beat the odds. I told him about the research on the effects of divorce on children, but he was convinced that he would continue to be a good father to his children and that they would get over the trauma of the divorce. I talked to Brent about the issues in this book and explained the difference between the experience of falling in love and the deep emotional need to feel loved. I explained the 5 love languages and challenged him to give his marriage another chance. All the while, I knew that my intellectual and reasoned approach to marriage compared to the emotional high that he was experiencing was like pitting a BB gun against an automatic weapon. He expressed appreciation for my concern and asked that I do everything possible to help Becky, but he declared that he saw no hope for the marriage. 1 month later, I received a call from Brent. He indicated that he would like to talk with me again. This time, when he entered my office, he was noticeably disturbed. He was not the calm, cool man I had seen before. His lover had begun to come down from the emotional high, and she was observing things in Brent that she did not like. She was withdrawing from the relationship, and he was crushed. Tears came to his eyes as he told me how much she meant to him and how unbearable it was to experience her rejection. I listened for an hour before Brent ever asked for my advice. I told him how sympathetic I was to his pain and indicated that what he was experiencing was the natural emotional grief from a loss and that the grief would not go away overnight. I explained, however, that the experience was inevitable. I reminded him of the temporary nature of the in-love experience, that sooner or later we always come down from the high to the real world. Some fall out of love before they get married, others after they get married. He agreed that it was better now than later. After a while, I suggested that perhaps the crisis was a good time for him and his wife to get some marriage counseling. I reminded him that true, long-lasting emotional love is a choice, and that emotional love could be reborn in his marriage if he and his wife learned to love each other in the right love languages. He agreed to marriage counseling, and 9 months later, Brent and Becky left my office with a reborn marriage. When I saw Brent 3 years later, he told me what a wonderful marriage they had and thanked me for helping him at a crucial time in his life. He told me that the grief over losing the other lover had been gone for more than 2 years. He smiled and said, "My tank has never been so full, and Becky is the happiest woman you're ever going to meet." Fortunately, Brent was the benefactor of what I call the disequilibrium of the in-love experience. That is, almost never do two people fall in love on the same day, and almost never do they fall out of love on the same day. You don't have to be a social scientist to discover that truth. Just listen to country and western songs. Brent's lover happened to have fallen out of love at an opportune time. Actions and emotions. In the 9 months that I counseled Brent and Becky, we worked through numerous conflicts that they had never resolved before. But the key to the rebirth of their marriage was discovering each other's primary love language and choosing to speak it frequently. What if the love language of your spouse is something that doesn't come naturally for you? I'm often asked this question at my marriage seminars, and my answer is, so? My wife's love language is acts of service. One of the things I do for her regularly as an act of love is to vacuum the floors. Do you think that vacuuming floors comes naturally for me? My mother used to make me vacuum. All through junior high and high school, I couldn't go play ball on Saturday until I finished vacuuming the entire house. In those days, I said to myself, when I get out of here, one thing I'm not going to do, I am not going to vacuum houses. I'll get myself a wife to do that. But I vacuum our house now, and I vacuum it regularly. And there's only one reason I vacuum our house. L-O-V-E. You could not pay me enough to vacuum a house, but I do it for love. You see, when an action doesn't come naturally to you, it is a greater expression of love. My wife knows that when I vacuum the house, it's nothing but 100% pure, unadulterated love, and I get credit for the whole thing. Someone says, "But Dr. Chapman, that's different. I know that my spouse's love language is physical touch, and I am not a toucher. I never saw my mother and father hug each other. They never hugged me. I'm just not a toucher. What am I going to do?" Well, do you have two hands? Can you put them together? Now imagine that you have your spouse in the middle and pull him or her towards you. I'll bet that if you will hug your spouse 3,000 times, it will begin to feel more comfortable. But ultimately, comfort is not the issue. We are talking about love, and love is something you do for someone else, not something you do for yourself. Most of us do many things each day that do not come naturally for us. For some of us, that is getting out of bed in the morning. We go against our feelings and get out of bed. Why? Because we believe there's something worthwhile to do that day. And normally, before the day is over, we feel good about having gotten up. Our actions precede our emotions. The same is true with love. We discover the primary love language of our spouse, and we choose to speak it whether or not it is natural for us. We are not claiming to have warm, excited feelings. We are simply choosing to do it for his or her benefit. We want to meet our spouse's emotional need, and we reach out to speak his love language. In so doing, his emotional love tank is filled, and chances are he will reciprocate and speak our language. When he does, our emotions return, and our love tank begins to fill. Love is a choice, and either partner can start the process today. Your turn. A key thought here is the idea of speaking our spouse's love language, whether or not it is natural for us. Why do you think this is so fundamental to a healthy marriage? Chapter 11. Love makes the difference. Love is not our only emotional need. Psychologists have observed that among our basic needs are the need for security, self-worth, and significance. Love, however, interfaces with all of those. If I feel loved by my spouse, I can relax, knowing that my lover will do me no ill. I feel secure in her presence. I may face many uncertainties in my vocation. I may have enemies in other areas of my life, but with my spouse, I feel secure. My sense of self-worth is fed by the fact that my spouse loves me. After all, if she loves me, I must be worth loving. My parents may have given me negative or mixed messages about my worth, but my spouse knows me as an adult and loves me. Her love builds my self-esteem. The need for significance is the emotional force behind much of our behavior. Life is driven by the desire for success. We want our lives to count for something. We have our own idea of what it means to be significant, and we work hard to reach our goals. Feeling love by a wife or husband enhances our sense of significance. We reason, if someone loves me, I must have significance. I am significant because I stand at the apex of the created order. I have the ability to think in abstract terms, communicate my thoughts via words, and make decisions. By means of printed or recorded words, I can benefit from the thoughts of those who have preceded me. I can profit from others' experiences, though they live in a different age and culture. I experience the death of family and friends and sense that there is existence beyond the material. I discover that in all cultures people believe in a spiritual world. My heart tells me it is true even when my mind, trained in scientific observation, raises critical questions. I am significant. Life has meaning. There is a higher purpose. I want to believe it, but I may not feel significant until someone expresses love to me. When my spouse lovingly invests time, energy, and effort in me, I believe that I am significant. Without love, I may spend a lifetime in search of significance, self-worth, and security. When I experience love, it influences all of those needs positively. I am now freed to develop my potential. I am more secure in my self-worth and can now turn my efforts outward instead of being obsessed with my own needs. True love always liberates. In the context of marriage, if we do not feel loved, our differences are magnified. We come to view each other as a threat to our happiness. We fight for self-worth and significance, and marriage becomes a battlefield rather than a haven. Love is not the answer to everything, but it creates a climate of security in which we can seek answers to those things that bother us. In the security of love, a couple can discuss differences without condemnation. Conflicts can be resolved. Two people who are different can learn to live together in harmony. We discover how to bring out the best in each other. Those are the rewards of love. We are like roommates. The decision to love your spouse holds tremendous potential. Learning their primary love language makes that potential a reality. At least it did for John and Susan. They had traveled for 3 hours to get to my office. It was obvious that John did not want to be there. Susan had twisted his arm by threats of leaving him. I do not suggest this approach, but people do not always know my suggestions before they come to see me. They had been married for more than 30 years and had never gone to counseling before. Susan began the conversation. Dr. Chapman, I want you to know two things up front. First of all, we don't have any money problems. I was reading in a magazine that money is the biggest problem in marriage. That's not true for us. We both have worked through the years. The house is paid for. The cars are paid for. We don't have any money problems. Second, I want you to know that we don't argue. I hear my friends talking about the arguments they have all the time. We've never argued. I can't remember the last time we ever had an argument. Both of us agree that arguing is fruitless, so we don't argue. As a counselor, I appreciated Susan's clearing the path. I knew that she was going to get right to the point. She continued, "The problem is that I just don't feel any love coming from my husband. Life is a routine for us. We get up in the morning and go off to work. In the afternoon, he does his thing and I do my thing. We generally have dinner together, but we don't talk. He watches TV while we eat. After dinner, he putters in the basement and then sleeps in front of the TV until I tell him it's time to go to bed. That's our schedule, 5 days a week. On Saturday, he plays golf in the mornings, works in the yard in the afternoon, and we go out to dinner with another couple on Saturday night. He talks to them, but when we get into the car to go home, the conversation is over. On Sunday morning, we go to church, and so on. We're like two roommates living in the same house. There's nothing going on between us. I don't feel any love coming from him. There's no warmth. There's no emotion. It's empty. It's dead. I don't think I can go on much longer like this." By that time, Susan was crying. I handed her a tissue and looked at John. His first comment was, "I don't understand her." After a brief pause, he continued, "I have done everything I know to show her that I love her, especially the last 2 or 3 years since she's been complaining about it so much. Nothing seems to help. No matter what I do, she continues to complain that she doesn't feel loved. I don't know what else to do." I could tell that John was frustrated and exasperated. I inquired, "What have you been doing to show your love for Susan?" "Well, for one thing," he said, "I get home from work before she does. So I get dinner started every night. In fact, if you want to know the truth, I have dinner almost ready when she gets home from work 4 nights a week. The other night, we go out to eat. I do all the vacuuming because her back is bad. I do all the yard work because she's allergic to pollen. I fold the clothes when they come out of the dryer." He went on telling me other things he did for Susan. When he finished, I wondered, "What does this woman do?" John continued, "I do all these things to show her that I love her. Yet she sits there and says to you what she has been saying to me for 2 or 3 years, that she doesn't feel loved. I don't know what else to do for her." Then I turned back to Susan. She said, "Dr. Chapman, all of those things are fine, but I want him to sit and talk to me. We don't ever talk. He's always doing something. I want him to sit on the couch with me and give me some time, look at me, talk to me about us, about our lives." Susan was crying again. It was obvious to me that her primary love language was quality time. She was crying for attention. She wanted to be treated as a person, not an object. John's busyness did not meet her emotional need. As I talked further with John, I discovered that he didn't feel loved either, but he wasn't talking about it. He reasoned, "If you've been married for 35 years, and your bills are paid, and you don't argue, what more can you hope for?" That's where he was. But when I said to him, "What would be an ideal wife to you? If you could have a perfect wife, what would she be like?" He looked me in the eye for the first time and asked, "Do you really want to know?" "Yes," I said. He sat up on the couch and folded his arms across his chest. A little smile broke on his face, and he said, "I've dreamed about this. A perfect wife would be a wife who would come home in the afternoon and fix dinner for me. I would be working in the yard. She would call me in to eat. After dinner, she would wash the dishes. I'd probably help her some, but she would take the responsibility. She would sew the buttons on my shirt when they fall off." Susan could contain herself no longer. She turned to him and said, "I'm not believing you. You told me you liked to cook." "I don't mind cooking," John responded, "but the man asked me what would be ideal." I knew John's primary love language without another word, acts of service. Why do you think John did all those things for Susan? because that was his love language. In his mind, that's the way you show love, by doing things for people. The problem was that doing things was not Susan's primary love language. It did not mean to her emotionally what it would have meant to him if she had been doing things for him. When John realized what his wife really needed, the first thing he said was, "Why didn't somebody tell me this 30 years ago? I could have been talking to her every night instead of doing all this stuff." He turned to Susan and said, "For the first time in my life, I finally understand what you mean when you say we don't talk. I could never understand that. I thought we did talk. I always ask, 'Did you sleep well?' I thought we were talking. But now I understand. You want to sit together and look at each other and talk. Now I understand what you mean. And now I know why it's so important to you. It is your emotional love language, and we'll start tonight. I'll give you 15 minutes every night for the rest of my life. You can count on that." Susan turned to John and said, "That would be wonderful. And I don't mind fixing dinner for you. It will have to be later than usual because I get off work later than you. But I don't mind fixing dinner, and I would love to sew your buttons on. You never left them off long enough for me to get them. I'll wash the dishes the rest of my life if it will make you feel loved." Susan and John went home and started loving each other in the right love languages. In less than 2 months, they were on a second honeymoon. After a trip to the Bahamas, they called to tell me what a radical change had taken place in their marriage. Can emotional love be reborn in a marriage? You bet. The key is to learn the primary love language of your spouse and choose to speak it. Your turn. What does your spouse do to make you feel more significant? How about what do you do for them? Chapter 12, Loving the Unlovely. It was a beautiful September Saturday. My wife and I were strolling through Enola Gardens, enjoying the flora, some of which had been imported from around the world. The gardens had originally been developed by R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco magnate, as a part of his country estate. They are now a part of the Wake Forest University campus. We had just passed the Rose Garden when I noticed Anne, a woman who had begun counseling 2 weeks earlier, approaching us. She was looking down at the cobblestone walkway and appeared to be in deep thought. When I greeted her, she was startled, but looked up and smiled. I introduced her to Carolyn, and we exchanged pleasantries. Then, without any lead-in, she asked me one of the most profound questions I've ever heard. "Dr. Chapman, is it possible to love someone whom you hate?" I knew that question was born of deep hurt and deserved a thoughtful answer. I knew that I would be seeing her the following week for another counseling appointment, so I said, "Anne, that is one of the most thought-provoking questions I've ever heard. Why don't we discuss that next week?" She agreed, and Carolyn and I continued our stroll. But Anne's question did not go away. Later, as we drove home, Carolyn and I discussed it. We reflected on the early days of our own marriage, and we remembered that we had often experienced feelings of hate. Our condemning words to each other had brought us hurt, and on the heels of hurt, anger, and anger held inside becomes hate. What made the difference for us? We both knew it was the choice to love. We had realized that if we continued our pattern of demanding and condemning, we would destroy our marriage. Fortunately, over a period of about a year, we had learned how to discuss our differences without condemning each other, how to make decisions without destroying our unity, how to give constructive suggestions without demanding, and eventually, how to speak each other's primary love language. Our choice to love was made in the midst of negative feelings toward each other. When we started speaking each other's primary love language, the feelings of anger and hate abated. Our situation, however, was different from Anne's. Carolyn and I had both been open to learning and growing. I knew that Anne's husband was not. She had told me the previous week that she had begged him to go for counseling. She had pleaded for him to read a book or listen to a speaker on marriage, but he had refused all her efforts toward growth. According to her, his attitude was, "I don't have any problems. You are the one with the problems." In his mind, he was right. She was wrong. It was as simple as that. Her feelings of love for him had been killed through the years by his constant criticism and condemnation. After 10 years of marriage, her emotional energy was depleted and her self-esteem almost destroyed. Was there hope for Anne's marriage? Could she love an unlovely husband? Would he ever respond in love to her? Love's greatest challenge. I knew that Anne was a deeply religious person and that she attended church regularly. I surmised that perhaps her only hope for marital survival was in her faith. The next day, with Anne in mind, I began to read Luke's account of the life of Christ. I have always admired Luke's writing because he was a physician who gave attention to details and in the first century wrote an orderly account of the teachings and lifestyle of Jesus of Nazareth. In what many have called Jesus' greatest sermon, I read the following words, which I call love's greatest challenge. I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. It seemed to me that the profound challenge written almost 2,000 years ago might be the direction that Anne was looking for. But could she do it? Could anyone do it? Is it possible to love a spouse who has become your enemy? Is it possible to love someone who has cursed you, mistreated you, and expressed feelings of contempt and hate for you? And if she could, would there be any payback? Would her husband ever change and begin to express love and care for her? I was astounded by this further word from Jesus' sermon. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Could that principle of loving an unlovely person possibly work in a marriage as far gone as Anne's? I decided to do an experiment. I would take as my hypothesis that if Anne could learn her husband's primary love language and speak it for a period of time, so that his emotional need for love was met, eventually he would reciprocate and begin to express love to her. I wondered, would it work? I met with Anne the next week and listened again as she reviewed the hurts of her marriage. At the end of her synopsis, she repeated the question she had asked in Rinalda Gardens. This time, she put it in the form of a statement. Dr. Chapman, I just don't know if I can ever love him again after all he has done to me. Have you talked about your situation with any of your friends? I asked. With two of my closest friends, she said, and a little bit with some other people. And what was their response? Get out, she said. They all tell me to get out, that he will never change, and that I'm simply prolonging the agony. But I just can't bring myself to do that. Maybe I should, but I just can't believe that's the right thing to do. It seems to me that you're torn between your religious and moral beliefs that tell you it's wrong to get out of the marriage, and your emotional pain, which tells you that getting out is the only way to survive, I said. That's exactly right, Dr. Chapman. That's exactly the way I feel. I don't know what to do. I'm deeply sympathetic with your struggle, I continued. You are in a very difficult situation. I wish I could offer you an easy answer. Unfortunately, I can't. Both of the alternatives you mentioned, getting out or staying in, will likely bring you a great deal of pain. Before you make that decision, I do have one idea. I'm not sure it will work, but I'd like to try it. I know from what you've told me that your religious faith is important to you, and that you have a great deal of respect for the teachings of Jesus. She nodded affirmingly. I continued, I want to read something that Jesus once said that I think has some application to your marriage. I read slowly and deliberately. I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. Does that sound like your husband? Has he treated you as an enemy rather than as a friend? She nodded. Has he ever cursed you? I asked. Many times. Has he ever mistreated you? Often. And has he told you that he hates you? Yes. The 6-month experiment. Anne, if you're willing, I would like to do an experiment. I would like to see what would happen if we apply this principle to your marriage. Let me explain what I mean. I went on to explain to Anne the concept of the emotional love tank and the fact that when the tank is low, as hers was, we have no love feelings toward our spouse, but simply experience emptiness and pain. Since love is such a deep emotional need, the lack of it is perhaps our deepest emotional pain. I told her that if we could learn to speak each other's primary love language, that emotional need could be met and positive feelings could grow again. Does that make sense to you? I inquired. Dr. Chapman, you have just described my life. I have never seen it so clearly before. We were in love before we got married, but not long after our marriage, we came down off the high, and we never learned to speak each other's love language. My tank has been empty for years, and I'm sure his has also. Dr. Chapman, if I had understood this concept earlier, maybe none of this would have happened. We can't go back, Anne, I said. All we can do is try to make the future different. I would like to propose a 6-month experiment. I'll try anything, Anne said. I liked her positive spirit, but I wasn't sure whether she understood how difficult the experiment would be. Let's begin by stating our objective, I said. If in 6 months you could have your fondest wish, what would it be? Anne sat in silence for some time. Then thoughtfully she said, I would like to see Glenn loving me again and expressing it by spending time with me. I would like to see us doing things together, going places together. I would like to feel that he's interested in my world. I would like to see us talking when we go out to eat. I'd like him to listen to me. I'd like to feel that he values my ideas. I would like to see us taking trips together and having fun again. I would like to know that he values our marriage more than anything. Anne paused and then continued. On my part, I would like to have warm, positive feelings toward him again. I would like to gain respect for him again. I would like to be proud of him. Right now, I don't have those feelings. I was writing as Anne was speaking. When she finished, I read aloud what she had said. That sounds like a pretty lofty objective, I said. But is that really what you want, Anne? Right now, that sounds like an impossible objective, Anne replied. But more than anything, that's what I would like to see. Then let's agree, I said, that this will be our objective. In 6 months, we want to see you and Glenn having this kind of love relationship. Now let me suggest a hypothesis. The purpose of our experiment will be to prove whether or not the hypothesis is true. Let's hypothesize that if you could speak Glenn's primary love language consistently for a 6-month period, that somewhere along the line, his emotional need for love would begin to be met, and as his emotional tank filled, he would begin to reciprocate love to you. That hypothesis is built upon the idea that the emotional need for love is our deepest emotional need, and when that need is being met, we tend to respond positively to the person who is meeting it. I continued, you understand that that hypothesis places all the initiative in your hands. Glenn is not trying to work on this marriage. You are. This hypothesis says that if you can channel your energies in the right direction, there's a good possibility that Glenn will eventually reciprocate. I read the other portion of Jesus' sermon recorded by Luke the physician. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. As I understand that, Jesus is stating a principle, not a way to manipulate people. Generally speaking, if we are kind and loving toward people, they will tend to be kind and loving toward us. That does not mean that we can make a person kind by being kind to him. We are independent agents. Thus, we can spurn love and walk away from love or even spit in the face of love. There's no guarantee that Glenn will respond to your acts of love. We can only say that there's a good possibility he will do so. A counselor can never predict with absolute certainty individual behavior. Based on research and personality studies, a counselor can only predict how a person is likely to respond in a given situation. After we agreed on the hypothesis, I said to Anne, now let's discuss your and Glenn's primary love languages. I'm assuming from what you have told me already that quality time may be your primary love language. What do you think? I think so, Dr. Chapman. In the early days, when we spent time together, and Glenn listened to me, we spent long hours talking together, doing things together, I really felt loved. More than anything, I wish that part of our marriage could return. When we spend time together, I feel like he really cares. But when he's always doing other things, I feel like business and other pursuits are more important than our relationship. And what do you think Glenn's primary love language is? I inquired. I think it is physical touch, and especially the sexual part of the marriage. I know that when I felt more loved by him and we were more sexually active, he had a different attitude. I think that's his primary love language. Does he ever complain about the way you talk to him? Well, he says I nag him all the time. He always says that I don't support him, that I'm always against his ideas. Then let's assume, I said, that physical touch is his primary love language and words of affirmation is his secondary love language. The reason I suggest the second is that if he complains about negative words, apparently positive words would be meaningful to him. Now let me suggest a plan to test our hypothesis. What if you go home and say to Glenn, I've been thinking about us, and I've decided that I would like to be a better wife to you. So if you have any suggestions on how I could be a better wife, I want you to know that I'm open to them. You can tell me now, or you can think about it and let me know what you think, but I would really like to work on being a better wife. Whatever his response, negative or positive, simply accept it as information. That initial statement lets him know that something different is about to happen in your relationship. Then, based on your guess that his primary love language is physical touch, and my suggestion that his secondary love language may be words of affirmation, focus your attention on those two areas for 1 month. If Glenn comes back with a suggestion as to how you might be a better wife, accept that information and work it into your plan. Look for positive things in Glenn's life and give him verbal affirmation about those things. In the meantime, stop all verbal complaints. If you want to complain about something, write it down in your personal notebook rather than saying anything about it to Glenn this month. Begin taking more initiative in physical touch and sexual involvement. Surprise him by being aggressive, not simply responding to his advances. Set a goal to have sexual intercourse at least once a week the first 2 weeks and twice a week the following 2 weeks. Anne had told me that she and Glenn had had sexual intercourse only once or twice in the past 6 months. I figured this plan would get things off dead center rather quickly. Oh, Dr. Chapman, this is going to be difficult, Anne said. I found it hard to be sexually responsive to him when he ignores me all the time. I felt used rather than loved in our sexual encounters. He acts as though I'm totally unimportant all the rest of the time and then wants to jump in bed and use my body. I have resented that, and I guess that's why we have not had sex very often in the last few years. Your response has been natural and normal, I assured Ann. For most wives, the desire to be sexually intimate with their husbands grows out of a sense of being loved by their husbands. If they feel loved, then they desire sexual intimacy. If they do not feel loved, they are likely to feel used in the sexual context. That is why loving someone who is not loving you is extremely difficult. It goes against our natural tendencies. You will probably have to rely heavily on your faith in God in order to do this. Perhaps it will help if you read again Jesus' sermon on loving your enemies, loving those who hate you, loving those who use you, and then ask God to help you practice the teachings of Jesus. I could tell that Anne was following what I was saying. Her head was nodding ever so slightly. Her eyes told me she had lots of questions. But Dr. Chapman, isn't it being hypocritical to express love sexually when you have such negative feelings toward the person? Perhaps it would be helpful for us to distinguish between love as a feeling and love as an action, I said. If you claim to have feelings that you do not have, that is hypocritical, and such false communication is not the way to build intimate relationships. But if you express an act of love that is designed for the other person's benefit or pleasure, it is simply a choice. You are not claiming that the action grows out of a deep emotional bonding. You are simply choosing to do something for his benefit. I think that must be what Jesus meant. Certainly, We do not have warm feelings for people who hate us. That would be abnormal. But we can do loving acts for them. That is simply a choice. We hope that such loving acts will have a positive effect upon their attitudes and behavior and treatment. But at least we have chosen to do something positive for them. My answer seemed to satisfy Anne, at least for the moment. I had the feeling that we would discuss that again. I also had the feeling that if the experiment was going to get off the ground, it would be because of Anne's deep faith in God. After the first month, I said, I want you to ask Glenn for feedback on how you're doing. Using your own words, ask him, Glenn, you remember a few weeks ago when I told you I was going to try to be a better wife? I want to ask how you think I'm doing. Whatever Glenn says, accept it as information. He may be sarcastic, he may be flippant or hostile, or he may be positive. Whatever his response, do not argue, but accept it and assure him that you are serious and that you really want to be a better wife. And if he has any additional suggestions, you're open to them. Follow this pattern of asking for feedback once a month for the entire 6 months. Whenever Glenn gives you the first positive response, you will know that your efforts are getting through to him emotionally. 1 week after you receive the first positive feedback, I want you to make a request of Glenn, something that you would like